Velkommen til en ny episode her fra Drinkfeed, og nå skal vi til, til Sicilia, dere. Det er jo en fantastisk plass på jorden, og jeg har jo kommet tilbake til den ganske mange ganger opp igjennom. Og nå sitter vi i Oslo, men vi har med en av de virkelig nestorene innenfor for denne regionen som heter Etna Wine, og fra... And I'm going to switch to English now because with me in studio I have Marco Di Grazia. You are sort of a leading figure in wine, and especially Sicilian wine, and running the Terranere Vineyard at the time. Welcome to you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
How long have you been into the wine business?
Business-wise, I started my... consulting and distribution company in Florence in 1980, so that makes it 45 years. Previously, I was an exceptionally busy amateur for many years, yes.
Can you tell us anything about the development of the wine industry in Italy from the last 45 years?
I mean, that would take, you know, days to explain, but the evolution has certainly been momentous, and... I don't think it would be in anyone's imagination the evolution, and very positive is certainly the, you know, when I started my distribution business in the 80s, I only distributed outside of Italy, and you know, the reputation of Italian wine outside of Italy was negligible. I mean, the wines that were exported, in the huge majority of the wines that were exported, went to, you know, immigrants, Italian immigrants, and their mom and pop little restaurants with the spaghetti and meatballs. And when I tried to sell fine wine, it took me 10 years before I got to sell to the Italian neighborhoods, let's say in New York or San Francisco. As the Italian cuisine gained quickly much more respect, and fine dining Italian restaurants opened all over the world, they became the vehicle for fine wine. And so it was encouraging in the early days, in the, let's say, late 80s, started being very successful. But for the first 5 or 6 years, I had to have another job to in order to survive. But, you know, little by little, and I think things exploded, quality Italian wine exploded in the mid-90s. Then we started getting really a lot of recognition from both the press and the consumer. And we rode and are still riding that wave, improving more and more.
And that was leading areas like the Piemont and Chianti and,
of course,
and those places.
The leading area, well, as far as I'm concerned, I worked very much with the wines of Piedmont, but at the same time with wines from all over Italy. So let's say that the wines of Tuscany were much more well known. Chianti Classico, Brunello di Montalcino were getting a good reputation. But the wines of Piedmont, everybody knew the word Barolo, but nobody drank it. You see, and it was difficult, and so difficult that the grapes, the price of the grapes for Dolcetto, which is a very wonderful but easy drinking wine, were more expensive than the grapes of Nebbiolo for Barolo. And if you would go to an estate and buy 3 or 4 cases of Dolcetto, and the few places which did bottle, they would give you a case of Barolo for free. That's how. Now, of course, it's the opposite. You know, the grapes of Nebbiolo are 4, 5, 10 times the price of Dolcetto grapes, and the reputation of Barolo is established. But in those days, no, for a variety of complex reasons, having especially to do with the fact that at the time, over 90% of the Nebbiolo grapes for Barolo in the Barolo and Barbaresco appellation were sold either to negociants or to co-ops. And so very, very few producers did their own bottling. And therefore, it was almost impossible to get fine Barolo.
And then after a while, you started to make wine yourself. you started to label your own wines, so to speak. Did you have any special focus when you started? And did you have a goal for what you wanted to achieve when you started to produce?
Well, I always worked with extremely high quality, small, let's say boutique wineries, you know. I don't like the name, but so be it. And so the focus was always on the highest quality and working together with the estates to get to the highest quality with all, you know, no compromises made, and also sustainability. We're the first ones to really work organically in the vineyards and so on. And we found a lot of opposition from our neighbors. We were considered crazy when we thinned out some of the grapes that were, you know, in the vines that were overloaded. It's a complex work that has to do with everything from the vineyard to the cellar and to the distribution. So when I was working in the days that I was working in distribution, what happened is as we were successful in making the wines more and more popular, of course, what happened is the prices of the vineyards grew more and more, and I could never afford to buy a vineyard anywhere in Barolo or Barbaresco as the prices mounted. Yes, of course, I've always wanted to produce fine wine of my own. At a certain point, I actually, with some friends, we started an estate in Argentina in 1995. And almost started another one in Armenia. The one in Argentina is still going strong. But then, one day in the late 1990s, 1998 or 99, I can't remember exactly, an estate from the Etna came to Florence to visit and wanted to give us the distribution for the foreign markets. And I just can't take a winery like that without being there. So I went down to see the winery and to taste what was going on in the cellars. And then for various reasons, I decided not to take it into my distribution. But while I was there, I stayed 4 or 5 days, rented a car, and went around tasting wines around the Etna area from vignerons that didn't even bottle the wine. So wines that were, let's say, not impeccably crafted, but what my job always had been was to, you know, I was like a truffle dog, to find the finest vineyards and the finest small producers and then to help them bring that wine that they produced to the highest level of quality. So I was used to tasting wines for their potential. So in tasting wines on the Etna, I found that the potential was absolutely remarkable. But having said that, the most remarkable of these things was that, in fact, it was the type of wine that I loved. So it was a cross between Burgundy and the Lange wines, the Barolos and Barbarescos. It had some of one and some of the other. And those are the wines that I always loved. And so I thought, because obviously living in Tuscany, it's not that we didn't have wonderful wines and wonderful vineyards there, but this was my type of wine, let's say. And so the adventure started. And it was a very difficult, but in the end, a remarkable adventure. And I'll do it all over again if I have to.
Well, I can see that because I actually visit your vineyard in Sicily with and the Terranera winery. And it's a magnificent place. It's so beautiful. And in a moment, we're going to taste one of your bottles. Before that, do you find it difficult to grow wines in a place that's so diverse in temperature and because in winter time it could be quite chill up in the hills, and in summertime it can be quite warm.
Well, in fact, yes. I mean, when I arrived, I thought I didn't. You know, I had a feeling I knew enough to start, but in fact, I had to start learning all over again, because appellation is different. And this one was extraordinarily different from all others that I had visited and worked in throughout Italy and even abroad. And so, but it took me 2 or 3 years to find the correct balance. Let's say, blending my way of, for instance, working the vineyard with the local way of working the vineyard. So it was in the beginning it was difficult and the logistics were difficult. Culturally, it was a different place, and so there are a lot of problems. But these are problems that eventually, if you have some kind of humbleness and some kind of understanding, you overcome fairly easily. And it took, just a few years to do that. But now, let's say after 25 years, because, I bought there in the year after, in 2000, so it's 25 years exactly. I have to say that I knew then that I would make very good wines, but I did not expect, truly, without any false modesty, I never expected to make wines as good as we're making now.
Because they are really great, and for us that have been fortunate enough to taste the various vintages, it seems only to get better, even with internal varieties and stuff. Shall we try the Terinera Etna Rosso? Is
the last vintage, 2024, just very recently bottled. We had to bottle a little early. I would have preferred to bottle a little later because I think it would have appreciated a little bit more time in oak. But the previous vintage, we produced 50% roughly of the our average production. So we ran completely out of wine very quickly. And we had some very good friends and clients that needed some continuity. So we did a small bottling for them, and this is the result. It's also, we've been very fortunate to have 4 remarkable vintages in a row. So,
can you talk me through the idea behind the wine, the grape to start with, and also what inside the wine do you look for in the end result?
First of all, I think it's extremely important to explain that I don't come from a enological education. I come from an education in classics. So I graduated in university in ancient Greek or comparative literature with a specialization in ancient Greek and its philosophy and its literature. And of course, that is a culture that has informed all of Western civilization. It was formative. And so what I loved, I tried, of that civilization, I tried to put into the wine. So the search was for good and beauty and elegance. And this is something that the Etna has potentially, and it was a question of just fine-tuning all the possible efforts in the vineyard and in the cellar to extract this beauty and this identity, its character from every vineyard. And that there are people that believe that adding something is a way of dealing with things and in winemaking. And there's my vision, which is in fact the opposite. You can call it Socratic winemaking. Socrates knew himself as called himself a midwife. He drew things out of the people, of the young people that he talked to. He never put things in them. He just helped them draw their character out, their thinking out. Of course, nobody in politics likes the citizens to think too much and they put them to death. But having said that, we still talk about them and respect them after 2,000 years, so he must have done something right. And that's what we do. We draw the baby from the vineyard as purely and as healthily as possible and try to place it in the bottle for the joy of whoever has the chance to taste it.
So when we're talking about wine philosophy, you are basically literate in that you're making wine based on classical philosophies. Okay, tell me about the grape inside this.
Nerello Mascalese is, I think, it's a grape that is very much like other great grapes, in some case more than other great grapes, very, very tied to its territory. So any attempt that has been made that I know of to produce it outside of the Etna, therefore outside of volcanic soils, not at high altitudes, has been unsuccessful. So in a sense, there's a good friend of mine in Burgundy that once when he was a guest and we were talking and drinking together, finally said, "You know, Marco, you know that I don't think that Pinot Noir is really a great grape. I think Pinot Noir is a great grape in Burgundy. And the same is true of Nerello Mascalese. The grape in itself is probably negligible another place, or may give you something, that enjoyable, but it will not give you the grandeur that it has on Etna. And why that is? Well, it's so complicated that it would take days, and I wouldn't really find an answer. It has to do with the fact that, yes, we have very, very warm days, but we have very, very cold nights. And so the temperature excursion is extraordinary at our high altitudes. It has to do with the soil and the susceptibility of the grape to all the different volcanic soils that we have, so that, a wine produced or grapes planted in a parcel could be very different from a wine produced from grapes in a parcel adjacent to it. We have, we produce a Santo Spirito and a Guardiola, and the vineyards are adjacent, and the wines are completely different because the soils are different, and because the altitude is different, and because, therefore, the temperatures are different. So much so that in 2002, my first bottle, on the back label, I daringly stated that for me, the Etna was the Burgundy of the Mediterranean.
Well, that was a bold statement, but I think actually people now recognize that. I've already smelled and tasted because I couldn't help myself while you were talking. Mm. And what are the main character that you will pull out from this particular wine?
First of all, our classic Etna Rosso, which is, let's say, the equivalent of a village in Burgundy. It doesn't have a single vineyard. It's made from vineyards of all different areas, but all very high-quality vineyards. And a lot of our Premier Cru young vines and our Grand Cru young vines go into it. So it is actually quite exceptional in and of itself. What I'm keen on specifying is that it is a very fine wine in and of itself without having to go to search even finer wines with the single vineyards. It's the most difficult wine to make. The greater the vineyard, the easier the wine to make. If you have a Grand Cru, I'm not saying that the wine makes itself because that would be silly, but it certainly helps. You might even make a mistake or two and it's still going to be a very fine wine. Making wine from 10 or 15 different vineyard sites is more complicated. It's more complicated to find a balance, and it's just a more complex workmanship. But we managed to make the finest possible. And what distinguishes Terinede from almost any other estate on Etna is the quality of the vineyards we have. We have the top vineyards in the top areas of the appellation. Consequently, even our classic wine is remarkable, ages beautifully, and one of the things that upsets me a bit is the fact that it's consumed so rapidly that people don't. I mean, it's wonderful when it's young. All the wines, that's another characteristic. Just like in Burgundy, all the wines are great when they're young, great when they're middle-aged, great when they start aging more. But it'd be nice to give it a chance, occasionally at least, you know, like get a case, drink 10 bottles, keep two of them for later drinking. But it is, you know, very much, its beauty is in its finesse, in its, the quality of its finesse. The quality of the wine lies in the generosity of its expression and the smoothness of its tannins and the richness on the palate and the length. It's not a big wine. It's easy to make a big wine. It's difficult to make a fine wine. And this, the Etna, has finesse in its blood. It's just a question of drawing it out. And that's what we try to do. That's what the wine is like.
Well, that was truly very well described how I felt when I tasted this first time. And I think the time has come to round up this little session. And there's no better way to do that by having a glass. So, Marco, thank you so much for taking us down to Sicily and present this beautiful wine. And I can see you are almost in a state of grace right now.
Well, it is. This and nothing has been opened overnight. And sometimes that good wine improves with a bit of oxygen. And right now I'm tasting things that I didn't taste yesterday with the open bottle. For instance, roses. It's amazing. And usually it doesn't have the character of roses, but it's coming out, especially on the palate. Really quite, I'm very proud of it.
Marvelous. Thank you so much. Thank
you. You're very welcome. Glad to be here with you. Hope to see you in Sicily soon.
Oh, don't worry. I'm going to be there.
Thank you.
Da runder vi av Ringfeed og Marco de Grasso. En fantastisk fyr, en fantastisk vingård, en fantastisk vin som vi akkurat har presentert oss. Etna Rosso fra Terre Nere koster 349,90, altså 350 kroner. Og som dere nå hørte Marco selv si, ja, dette er jo verdt hver eneste krone. Så da runder vi av fra, herfra Drinkfeed og koster videre.